Thank you, everybody. First off, I want to thank Rob for inviting me back, and Mike Pasak. And I see that Steve Kordak's in the audience, so if I say something wrong, I hope Steve doesn't hit me. My name is Mike Eady, and I collect 30s machines. I have a big collection of other machines also. There's actually four parts in it. So you don't think I'm a total 30s geek. I'll tell you about those for a second. I do have some of the newer digital machines, the MDs and the EMs from the 70s. That's mostly my players. I have a secondary collection of cocktail table pins. Now, if you talk to my wife, they're for sale because we have them stacked 2 and 3 high, and she absolutely hates them because you can't take them apart and stuff them in a short storage locker, and they take up tons of room. The third part is Ataris. I have multiples of all the Atari productions. Now, I don't have a 4x4 or Roadrunner, but I do have a Hercules. And maybe someday I'll talk on those. I have a friend that actually worked for Atari that does business with me. And every time I see him, he goes, oh, yeah, well, yeah, we did this at Atari. And da, da, da. I said, come to Pinball. I said, no, no, nobody wants to hear about Atari. They were gone. But the last part is 1930s games. And 1930s games for me is very exciting. For most people, it's probably a big yawn. Okay, there's no ramps. Gee, there's no electronics. There's no speech, no video. Who cares about it? Well, it started off the whole pinball deal. If there wasn't for the 30s games and for the payouts, we probably wouldn't be sitting here today. So you got to give it credit at that point. What I'll do is I'll talk about a number of the different versions of the 30s payouts. And most of them were called one balls, because unlike the games of today where you're playing 5 balls or 3 balls or you get a multi-ball, these you got one ball, one shot to make it. Let's take a step back for a second now. Let's go back and let's go back to 1976 or 1977, and I'm sure you all know Roger Sharp. If you don't, you haven't been to a pinball expo for many years. Roger's a great guy, but in 1977, you couldn't play pinball in Chicago, as you just heard from our last speaker. You could not play pinball in New York City, and you could not play pinball in LA. And the main reason is pinball got such a terribly bad name as a gambling device from the 30s, which held on to the bingos and the other games. They said absolutely no pinballs because they're not a game of skill, they're a game of chance, just like slot machines and any other gambling device. Even though they're made in Chicago, you can't have them there. You can't have them in New York. And Roger Sharp says this is not right. The new games in the 1970s are a game of skill, not a game of chance. Now, up to that point, and you'll see throughout the whole presentation, every pinball manufacturer put on their gambling pinballs, this is a game of skill. You have to be skillful to play this. But in truth, it was a game of chance, and it could be changed, the odds, just like a slot machine. In New York, it was called the LaGuardia Band, and I know it's a crappy picture. Some of my pictures I hijacked from the Internet Pinball Database. So bear with me, but that's, I believe his name was Firlo or something like that, LaGuardia, pushing over a pinball machine. So anyways, the story goes that Roger went into this city council meeting and said, look, pinball's a game of skill, not chance. And to prove it, he brought in a couple pinball machines and challenged every one of the council members to play pinball and said, I can beat you because I'm very skillful and you're not. And he proceeded to beat the pants off of everybody. And they voted, and from that time, then New York dropped its ban, Chicago dropped its ban, and later LA dropped its ban. So it went from the, you can't play pinball because it's a gambling device, which now I've heard in one of the earlier talks, they're trying to make the video pinball a slot machine gambling, which if you look at some of the IGTs, which you talk to Joe Kamakow, which I'm sure is the speaker, he went from pinballs over to slot machines, and there's been a couple slot machine pinballs. Okay, my first one, the Bally Red Arrow. Now, Bally's been making pinballs for a while now. This is about 1934. Bally came out with Ballyhoo. That was their first big pinball. And Ray Maloney, who actually started Bally, was a jobber for Williams because Williams couldn't produce enough of these pinball machines to get them out on the streets fast enough. So he found other people or other jobbers to produce them for him. And Ray went, this is great. Why building them for him. I'm going to build them and start my own company. At that time, there was a popular magazine. I was going to bring a copy with me. I managed to grab a hold of a couple of them called Ballyhoo. And when they came out with the original Ballyhoo pinball machine, they sang at the deal, where they were playing 32. I won't sing it all. Ballyhoo. And it started from there. Well, Bally went in, and they, as everybody else did, they started producing gambling ones. But they were one-ball gambling machines. And remember, we're in the middle of the Great Depression. Virtually, it's a real class system now. There is certain people that have money and are holding on to it. And there's all these people that just don't have jobs, they don't have money, they need money, they're in soup lines, food lines, a nickel that's worth $1 million. So you look at the ads, and it's saying things like, if you can read in the top of this one, that plays 200 to 250 games per hour. And your take is about 40% on this game. So you do the math, what that is. The game cost $95 at that time. And they had already produced other games like Rocket and Champion and Signal and things like that. And they're great machines, but this one just is one of my favorites, and it was the biggest hyped one you could find. Now, in other advertisements, they're really pushing those machines. They say, can you imagine $1,000 a week? Well, I bet you the people at Williams in 1999 wish they could get $1,000 a week for their pinballs because they'd still be producing them. They also say that if you don't get $90 pay in your first week of owning this pinball machine, we'll buy it back. In 1934, if somebody had $95, they were out there buying these machines. That's when a doctor who went through college made $61 a week. Somebody could afford a pinball machine, put it on a good location, from one pinball machine could make more than a doctor. Now figure that one out. Well, the deal was, they were a game of skill, not luck, by the way. But for your nickel, you had the chance, however incredibly slim, to make a dollar back if you got in the right hole. These are automatic payout machines, by the way. Batteries that come in to use in the pinball machines to light lights up and do different things. There's minute use of relays and kickers and things like that by this time. And eventually they went to power packs. But we'll look at how you could change the odds in a little bit, but you could make a dollar back, so that really enticed people. If I can put this nickel in, maybe make a dime or 30 cents back, gee, it looks like I have good odds. Just like today, you go to Vegas, what are you going to do? It's a nickel machine, but you got to pay 35 nickels to get the big jackpot, and you see the people just pumping the money into the machines. And don't let them believe that they built the big hotels off of giving you back your money, because they don't. So anyways, it's a game of skill, not luck. In the same ad, even though they say it's a gambling machine, they say a real skill game. BS, and we'll find out in a second. They say even say the red arrow is innocent. It's just skill. It's a child's game. It's innocent. It's a fascinating skill game again. In appearance and in fact it is. Now these people are just fighting to get everybody to believe that it's not a gambler so that they don't take it off the streets and destroy it, which a lot of them got put into speakeasies and areas where, you know, bars, but you'd also see them in restaurants, you'd see them in barbershops and things like that. So they wanted to try to get a better name, but it was definitely a gambler. Now, how many of you on the skill shots, think it's really easy to sit there and then, like, let's say Twilight Zone, you get the plunger back, and you're sitting there, and you make it just up so you trip that third switch on the Twilight Zone, and when the ball comes back, and you get the, what is it, 10,000 or 10 million or 10 billion or zillion points or whatever for that skill shot, or you get it up just to the top, and you make it fall in the right guy. That's a real skill shot. And still hard. You all know how hard it is. How many people have taken Twilight Zone and pulled back the plunger and goes right over the edge down to the toilet? Not only did this game have the skill shot, but you took and you shot the ball there, you went all the way around before you came up. Made it real easy to get the skill shot. If you just went up there and it fell on the play field, yeah. But no, you have to go all the way around the play field. Now, to give it credit, they did have a free play down here, so if you didn't even make it there, you didn't lose your ball. But I tell you the truth, I played this game for years because it's one of my favorite stuff in my 1930s realm. I never made the dollar shot. My 10-year-old nephew walks in, literally has never played a pinball machine in his life, pulls back the plunger, ball goes around, boom, it falls right in the dollar payout hole. So you figure out how skillful it really was. You can tell that the machine is a nice looking, it has great visual appeal. Back then, Bally obviously did want to spend money on different things. They did a lot of castings and on deco look and different things. This big casting down the bottom, you'll see in some later slides, was a form of it was used on other Bally machines. And it was also their scoring mechanism. On early pins, you had to add up the points yourself. Well, Bally came up where it's, when the balls rolled down, it would flip little levers and show you the score. You still had to add them up, but it would actually show you so you didn't have to go, well, this hole has one ball in it, and this hole has, you know, da, da, da. You could go on and do it that way. Again, right on the game, it says one ball, 5 cents, skill, amusement only. Okay, to make it even harder, let's make this so simple that you can't lose as an operator. To make it even harder, they didn't have one, but they had two tilt mechanisms on this. And the tilt mechanisms were so hard to keep the ball up. Actually, mine, I put the wires together. It's almost impossible, because what happens is there's a brass ball sits on top of a plunger. Now, when you put your coin in, the plunger drops down to pick up this ball. When you pull the coin slide back out, the plunger moves up into the air, so this ball is barely teetering on top of this plunger there. And you have two of them, not one. If the ball falls off, you've lost immediately. You can shoot the ball for the heck of it, but you're not going to win anything. So you really can't put any English onto it. And like I said, they did not one, but they did two. And you don't think that's a teetering ball? To make it harder, I've seen games where operators have actually taken and sanded down the ridges on the outside to make it almost totally impossible to get the ball up there. As a matter of fact, one of mine picks up the ball every time, no problem. The other one, about 5% of the time, the ball stays up there the rest of the time. You sneeze and the next block or county and the ball rolls off. Now, you're going down, you're shooting in the play field, we see a high-value hole. And remember, it says 100. If you walked up to a game and said 100, and you were playing nickel, I get 100 nickels back. I'm going to be a big winner. Uh-uh. The 100 was actually a dollar. You get 20 nickels back. You get one ball. Top of the play field up top here. Ball's coming down. Gee, you think that the ball is going to go outside here, or the ball is going to attack, just go right in there. It was almost impossible to get the ball in there, unless you're a 10-year-old guy from California. But now we go to the missed hole. Gee, they make it just as rough to get in the missed hole. And if you actually look at some of the other missed holes, the ball's actually guided into them. You'll see later in a PAMCO game, they took all the other guides and ran them into the missed holes. But still, these games, sorry for this picture, it was a little bad, but you can see the 10, at least they opened it up a little bit easier so you could get a little chance of getting 10. Now, 10, remember, wasn't 10 nickels, it was 2 nickels, so you got a 50% payback on it. Chances weren't good you're going to get it, chances are you're going to get in the missed hole. And that's what's going to show up on your score right there, missed. And you get absolutely nothing. And as a matter of fact, the two holes right here and here, right next next to the tilts are also missed. So if it makes it all the way down to the bottom of the play field, you missed again. No nudging. Just want to make sure I'm not missing anything because I get excited and just go on and on. One of the other things to think about is when pinball started, they were all mechanical. Remember, we're talking 1930. A lot of houses didn't have electricity. A lot of bars didn't have electricity back then. They were experimenting with AC. They were experimenting with DC. I lived in a house in Cleveland for a while that had DC outlets. Obviously, they weren't working, but they had DC outlets still on them. So when the batteries started coming in, they started using telephone batteries. And they would turn on a light bulb or something. There's a beam light out there in the display area. And basically, you get the ball in the holes, they'd light a light bulb. And boy, this was a great great innovation in pinball because now the player could see they did something, lit a light bulb, big deal. Well, if you light a light bulb, just like you turn on your flashlight, or if I hold the laser pointer on for, well, laser pointer would be a few days or weeks, but if you hold it on, the battery's going to die. And the people didn't want to keep replacing these batteries, they wanted to make them last as long as possible, so what they did is they built a little timer mechanism, which is nothing more than just a little clockwork like you'd see in an egg timer. When you reset the game, this bar would come out, it would cock the timer, and it would close the switch, which would make the battery circuit, and turn on the game. Well, when the timer ran down, the switch would open and turn off the power to the batteries, which would save the batteries. Now, by the time the gamblers came in, there was more and more what they called power packs in these games, which were an AC equivalent. You could plug into the wall if you had power, and they would power the game. They left this in, though, because if the game malfunctioned or somebody figured out how to cheat the game, they had a slim time frame to do it in. Because if you push the nickel in, you pulled it back, it started ticking. Okay, you now have, I think I timed this one after I got working, you have 22 seconds to play your ball and win and for the payout mechanism to actually pay you. After that amount of time, you can do anything you want. The ball would sit in the hole, great. You won, you never got your money. Again, they made it just so easy to play. Well, Bally didn't only make the arrow. The arrow was a great game. It's a lot of fun. But they started taking their regular non-payout games and making payout versions of them. This is a Bally Blue Ribbon. I have one of these that was my wife's game when she was a child. Yes.
Can you say a little bit about how with just the battery they were able to dispense 20 nickels?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that in a minute. I got a couple pictures here. So the Blue Ribbon was a non-payout game, and if you can see the casting down at the bottom, the scoring mechanism is about the same. They used it in a lot of their games. This one happened to have the toilet seats, as they were affectionately called by Bally. And what would happen is when you'd play the game, and this was a non-payout, so you just played the score, the ball would drop in there. When the ball dropped in, it would trip it and close the toilet seat, and down there, it would show you your score. And so you couldn't go in the same hole more than once. So after they came out with a Blue Ribbon, they came out with a Bally Rocket. And I think I have one of the first rockets because on my casting, it looked like the hand-engraved rocket where Blue Ribbon was. And if you look at the game is totally identical between Blue Ribbon and Rocket. The only difference is, it's Rocket, you get one ball. And Blue Ribbon, you have five balls. And the Rocket cabinet is deeper and has a payout mechanism in it. And there's, I'm not quite sure how many, but I would guess at least 20 in this time frame that Bally did this. Rather than invent a whole new game, a whole new play field, they would just take the existing play field and make it a payout. Well, Bally wasn't the only game in town. Here's another rocket. You can see that it has the multiple automatic payout mechanism on it. And automatic great profit and everything like that. They were very big for hyping it, but saying, it's a skill game, folks. This isn't gambling. There was other people. Now, Mills made slot machines for years. So they were into gambling. And Mills made trade stimulators. They were sort of like the GM of arcade equipment at the time. They had their fingers into everything. They were a privately owned, family-owned company. So they could do things that other companies couldn't because they didn't have to answer to a board of directors or anything like that. So Bill Mills says, well, we make these little slot machines, these QTs. We can't get them in the locations because they don't allow gambling. So what we'll do is we'll bowl a QT slot machine on the front of a pinball machine. We make pinballs. We'll just put the two together. So their first actually going into the payouts was nothing more than a slot machine. You put your coin in, you pay the slot machine. If you won on the slot machine, you didn't get paid. You then pulled the plunger back, and you played the pinball game. And if you got over a certain point, which you couldn't not get over a certain point, because in this case now, unlike the other, they made them go into the holes. You would get paid out from your slot machine pay. So Mills thought this was a great idea, but everybody's going, no, this is a slot machine. You can't have it in our location, stuff like that. Mills really wanted a bit of the pie. They really wanted some money in because Bally, Jennings, all these other companies were making all this money. So they had this great idea that they would make one that had a multiple head. I don't know how many of you are into slot machines, but the original slot machines looked like a huge roulette wheel. And you have a multiple head up top, and you bet on what color would come up on the wheel when you spun it. And if you won on that color, then it would pay you out. So they made one, and this used to be Mr. Burke's, and this is now one of my new favorites. It's called a Mills Railroad. Well, the railroad really wasn't their first one. They had another one called Tycoon, but we won't go into the story of Tycoon today. It was a huge failure because it broke constantly. And they pulled it out and retooled it and became the railroad. So this threw a new, let's say, kink into winning. All these people were already fed up with all the ballets where, gee, I can't win because there's pins in front of the holes that I want to get into, and I can't bounce it because there's all these tilt mechanisms and stuff like that. And Mills says, oh, we're going to make it easy. I mean, look the hole. We got a little springy thing here. That's on a 10. We got 10 now. That's wide open. We got 60. That's fairly wide open. We got 10 here. How can you miss with our game? We don't put tons of pins on them. Well, they do put some. Later on, you'll see where some of the pins are missing from the 100, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But they had 7 tracks you could bet on. And remember, airplanes weren't real popular at the time. Airlines were just starting to come into vogue where people could fly. It took basically 40 hours to get from New York to L.A. So the big thing was trains. That was the elegant way to travel across country. So they capitalized on this by taking the name of the popular railroad lines, and you bet on which railroad line. Oh, and we'll bet a nickel on the Gulf and a nickel on the Penn Central. Well, the only problem with that is the Gulf railroad line goes right here, goes up, and goes there. And the Penn Central, which I think was this one, is this one right here. So you play your ball. It doesn't have to go all the way around now. You can do a skill shot. Unfortunately, if you went on the Penn Central or the Gulf and your ball landed here, 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 or here, you didn't get paid. And if you look at them, 20 again was 4 nickels. So you get 40 cents back. 10 was 2 nickels. So you had a better chance of winning, but you had to bet more to get anything back. And there was no missed holes on this. If you bet all 7, you were guaranteed to win on something. But you could win a dime back for playing 35 cents, which really wasn't that great. Let me take a sidetrack here for a second. As the games were in locations, they would lose popularity because people were saying, I can't win. And so what the distributors would do, or they were winning too much. Now we've all taken, and even on the EMs, and especially on the new digitals, on your outlines you have little posts, you loosen the screw and you move the post back or forth to make it easier or harder for the ball to go out in the outline. I'm sure all of you have worked from one pinball machine to another one and you've nudged it a little bit and you still drained it down the outline because somebody moved the post way up and there's no way to nudge it back in. It actually started back here. If you look down here on the hundreds from the factory, there was 3 pins in front of the 100 And on the 60, there was two pins there. And on the 80, there was two more there. And somebody has pulled them out to make it easier to get those. Well, if they want to make it easier, they pull the pins. If they want to make it harder, they drive more pins in. So that was a way of changing the odds on the game. If all of a sudden they go out and they look and they're not getting their 40%, they're now getting 10% or 20%, they look at where it was paying, go out there with a hammer and drive more pins in. And if the barkeeper says, nobody's playing because nobody can win on the damn thing and stuff like that, you go out there with his hammer, rip a couple pins out of the 10 and 20 holes, make it easier for them to win, change the odds, let them win a little bit. So you can see that they kept coming up with new and more creative ideas and ways to make these exciting for people. I mean, you look at the playfield, this game is a masterpiece of Art Deco design, from the castings, and, oh, gee, this is for school and amusement, by the way, too. It's not a gambling machine. But they had huge castings on them. The cabinets were just phenomenal. It was just, in today's, the money that would cost to produce these today, I don't think the people would do it, because there was so much innovative design in them and things like that. The playfields that held up 70 years later, and I've gone through and I see that you're now paying $1,000 to have a playfield repainted and diamond plated or lacquered or whatever, and this one hasn't been touched. The only thing that was done to this is it was cleaned with some ballet wax, and nothing else is done to it, and all the paint's there, nothing's wrong with it. I just thought that was a cool shot. But you can get an idea, if you're the ball, you go down, it's hard to, when you bounce, you see, and you go, and inevitably, if you win, it's a 10. If you win, it's a 20. And, of course, Mills was a little bit cagier, too. Now, remember, Mills has been in the slot machine business, so they know how to hide things. Make things a little cagey. Their payout drawer wasn't just big hole in the side of the machine like Bally had it, so you could just scoop out your money and everybody saw that you won. You had to pull out a little hidden drawer. So you had to know where the money was being dispensed. You could hear it because the motor, which I'll tell you about in a minute, Dave, ground out this clunk, clunk, clunk of these coins that were sitting in there, these nickels. But you actually had to know where the drawer was, pull out the drawer to get your winnings. And if you see it, I mean, the carvings, the Art Deco, the big wheels, going back to the railroad theme. It was just, they took time to do things that I don't think that a lot of the people would say, oh, that's cool, but yeah. But back then, it was all manual labor. You didn't have CNC machines, you didn't have computers to do this. This was all done by hand. And of course, that's me with my happy railroad machine. Let me take a minute and talk about what Dave was asking about. He said, how did they pay out nickels with just batteries? Well, telephone batteries were 1.5 volts. Most of these games would take 6 to 8 batteries. And they would get 12 to 18 volts off the 6 to 8 batteries. And so they had a motor, and actually in one of the booths out there, there's a couple motors that are from 30s machines. And it had a stepper. And depending on where you landed, it would step up the number of coins that you won, and then it would step down every time it circulated. It would turn and geared it down, and it would turn a wheel and pull them out of the tube. When you played your coin, the coin would slide down, and it would either drop in the tube, and after the tube was full, then it would drop into the cash box. So as you played, you were filling the payout tube automatically. And every time it paid out, the wheel would just go around and take one coin off, shave it off, and then move it to the payout mechanism. That's another reason they wanted the batteries to stay. That's why they had the timer on there. And when the power packs came, they used the same voltage. They just put the power pack in. The power pack was nothing more than a transformer and a rectifier.
So the timer would perhaps stop in mid-dispensation?
I've had that happen. I've been there where I've played it, and I said, oh, I'm going to get this just right. I'm just going to shoot this just right, or I'm talking to somebody about it. I'm all excited there, and I'm showing them all the things and stuff like that, and I pull it, and it goes right in the winning hole, and they're saying, yeah, your game's a piece of crap. It doesn't work. You just won. It didn't pay out. and you know that the timer timed out. And as a matter of fact, on most of these, I find out that somebody sprayed 10,000 pounds of WD-40 in the timer, and they're all gummed up, and people just take and put a wire over top of it. And you clean them with ultrasonic cleaner and other things, and they come right back to life. Well, there's another company, and I haven't found out the total answer to this, though. It's called PAMCO, Pacific Amusement Company. PAMCO's take on the payout was a little bit different. They said, we're going to make this even tougher, but we're going to make this more fun. So what PAMCO did, horse racing was enormously popular then. They took and they put a drum in their head. They had this little teeny mini head in the back of their game. When you push your nickel into the coin slot, the drum would spin and randomly stop on the line of figures. Now, horse heads would come up. Obviously, some came up more often than others, just like a reel on a slot machine. There's certain symbols that come up, but they would always stop, and some of them, like, was that Myrtle Wood or Mr. Bones or Discovery? So at that point, your skill was to get in the hole that horse's head was up on. And if you got the ball in the hole for that horse's head, it would pay. Once again, it's really easy to do. PAMCO took, and they used these big, huge springs that if your ball hit it, it just bounced totally out. And they even took, for the good payouts like the 50, gee, that's going to be an easy one to get into right there. You literally, the only way you could do it is if you're good enough not to tilt it and get the ball below it, bounce on the spring below it. Sometimes you get to bounce up into the hole, but not very often. And, I mean, they did on every one like that. But on the other hand, they were nice enough to even put a daily double in there that physically the ball could not fit through those pins. And originally when I got it, I said, oh, I got the wrong size ball. So I went out and I looked at it and everything like that, measured everything up, and I said, no, this is the right size ball. And I went back there. Oh, the pin's bent. No, the pin's not bent. No, you couldn't. So nobody ever got the daily double. And on top of all, they were so grateful for you that they actually took you and took you right to the scratch hole. At least you could get in there and make a few bucks, you know. So to start it all off, I mean, you know, these were fun because people didn't have money. They needed something to do. And on every one of these, by the way, there's a slug rejector. And basically, it would reject anything anybody put in. Unlike the trade stimulators, it would take any coin because they just wanted whatever coin you could take. They weren't nickel, penny, quarter. They would just take any coin. There was a little window, and when the barkeep would pay you out, he'd look at what coin you paid. So if it's 10 to 1, you play the penny, you get 10 cents. You pay a nickel, you get 50 cents. Well, these, they didn't want you playing slugs. So I don't think I got a slide of it, but they always had a little window you could look down into and see if it was in question. You were playing a slug, you could see the nickel sitting right there. And they also had checks. I don't know if any of you know what checks are, but slot machines, another way of getting around gambling was not to pay out in coins. What they do is they pay out with what looked like a coin, but it had a hole through the center. It was called a trade check. And a trade check was, it looked just like a coin, and you get paid out in them, and you'd walk up to the bartender and you'd say, I want a beer. Or, gee, can I cash these in? It was a way of getting around gambling laws. And so they had check separators, so that when you came, the checks would be in one pile, and your coins would be in the other pile. PAMCO also decided that, gee, this looks a little too much like a gambling deal. We got horses on it, we got a spinning reel that could be mistaken for a slot machine, all this other stuff, so we're going to dispense tickets. The tickets are going to be verification that you won. You don't get a ticket until you win. We don't put anything on the ticket. You don't put how much you won on the ticket. But you won. And you can see the OK is the tilt mechanism on this one. Well, how did you do it? Well, you see the little lock box there? And you notice before anybody says that, it's a modern lock, it's not an old fashioned lock, but they're hard to come by and expensive. That's where your money went. And up top, there is where your ticket came out. So if you won, you take your ticket, you walk over to the barkeep, and you say, I just won on a pamphlet. And he said, okay, you come over, and you open it up with this key, and you get your money. That way, if a cop or somebody they suspect is a police officer or somebody that was going to bust a joint came in and say, I got this ticket, I just won. He'd say, great, you got a ticket, that's nice. Don't I get money? No. Is there a payout mechanism on it? I don't see a payout mechanism on it. Well, what's the lock for? Well, that's where I get my money that you left in the machine. But, of course, if you were a regular person in there, you knew that you went over to Bob the bartender, Bob would come over with his little key. And that also shows how often you want. Because if you want every time, I'm sure Bob won't want to drag his big butt from behind the bar and go over there and get your money out. This is actually from a later Mills. This is from a Mills Pearl Harbor. And it was produced before the Japs bombed Pearl Harbor. So I found it kind of interesting. And actually, this is a recent acquisition of mine, and they hid it underneath the playfield. It had a lock on it, but you had to reach underneath and back to open it up, and then the money would just come flowing out to your hand right there. And I thought it was rather interesting. And the interesting thing was, I was bidding on this game on eBay, and I emailed the guy, you know, I'll send you a crate and all this other stuff. And I looked at it on the Internet Pinball Database, and I said, oh, this looks like a fun game, you know, da-da-da. Any 30s game looks like a fun game to me. And I'm playing around with it. I get the machine. It sits at my house for a month. My wife goes, if you don't open it up, I'm putting it back on eBay and selling it. So I uncrate it, and I'm looking at it, and I'm telling her, oh, this is really cool, da-da-da. And she goes, it's the same machine. It was the same machine that was on the Internet Pinball Database. I couldn't believe it, because there was a piece missing. And the one in all the flyers showed a round piece of trim, and this one has a rectangular piece of trim. Oh, this is Max, the pin dog. Somebody opened up a can of food somewhere about 6 miles away, and his head turned. He wouldn't let me take a picture of the other pin until I got him. If food opens up anywhere in the universe, Max knows about it. So anyways, I'll show you a couple pictures of those in a minute, and I'll let you ask some questions. Jennings, who also made slots, made them, but Jennings was bold enough, we're not going to use batteries. Why use batteries? They cost money. Take service. Put a slot machine handle on ours. And that's how they did it. I don't know how they got by with it. They didn't seem to have problems. They produced a number of them. I got six of them. And one of the biggest and most highly produced was the Sportsman. And if anybody's seen 30s machines out there, I'm sure you've seen a Jennings Sportsman payout, because it was all the ones Jennings put out, the Sportsman was their big one. And it says, no tokens delivered if tilted. And you can see the little tilt ball falling off the bob at the side, the big missed ones, and where all the pins were on the other. And the 1,000, don't even think about that. The holes are too small for it to go in. Here's my Pearl Harbor. Just that it was kind of cool. Rather than out, they had reefs. And they had the different islands for different amounts. I remember you're going here, and you can probably see the little pins. Again, it's impossible to get to 40 or 50, but it'll go right into the reef. There's a picture of the reef, and I think that's it.
You ever modify them? You know, when you say the balls are impossible, you ever modify them so you personally can play them and get them?
Most of the time, what I try to do is Mike Pasak, about 4 years ago, allowed me to go through his flyer collection and his Billboard magazine collection and make copies of flyers from the 30s machines. Now remember, Billboard was a variety magazine that showed vaudeville shows, gambling machines, and pinballs of the time. So it was like, Game Room or Playbill of the time. So they had lots of ads. So rather than modify them to make it easier, what I try to do is take them back to what the factory had them at. Because most of the time I find them where they've either removed large amounts of pins to make it easier for the kids that eventually inherited all these machines, as my wife did on hers. The kids always wanted to win, they liked hearing the money come out, and the parents didn't want to have to go out to the box, so they just, modify them that way. or there'd be too many pins in it because it came off location and sat in some warehouse somewhere for years. And so I try to put them back the way they were originally.
Even though you can't, certain holes you couldn't hit even?
Yeah, it's just, it's funny to watch people come over. And when you get people come over to the house, I get two different kinds of people. I get the people, I have a 1930s room. And let me set this down for a second to show you. This is funny. They'll put their hands behind their back, and they'll very carefully walk through the room like it's the Louvre Museum. I don't want to sneeze. I don't want to touch anything. And then I'll get the other kind of person to come through, which, so they're sort of the other extreme. They'll grab the nickels they're sitting on top of the machine, jam them in there, pull them back, and they'll start bashing the machine against the wall and stuff like that. That's sort of like the person in between. But I love to sit there and watch them. Like I said, my nephew came, and he, gee, Uncle Mike, how'd you do this? Well, you got to push the ball up first, and then you pull back. First time he hit the 100. And it's like, how did you do that? He'll never be able to do it again. And he has, and he's 16 years old every time. So he goes, I'm going to play that red arrow and go win all your money again and then get out of here. He's never hit it again. Although at one time he was over and I have a bunch of slot machines. And this was funny. I think he was about 6 years old at the time. And he was playing the slot machines. And I have all the signs on the slots. They're for amusement only. You play with the house's money, you leave the house's money. In Ohio, any slot machine's legal. So my wife goes, oh, Ben's getting ready to leave. His dad came to pick him up and stuff, my brother. And he said, okay. So Ben, did you have a good time? Yeah, I had a good time, Uncle Mike. Six-year-old, his pants are about down to the floor right now. Both hands holding his pants up. And he said, bye, Uncle Mike. I said, eh. I was about ready to take him by the ankles. Yeah, he had taken all the quarters and nickels out of the slot machines and put them in his pants and was pulling his pants down to his ankles. But he had a good time, so he couldn't understand why he couldn't keep them and take them home. Does anybody have any questions on the 30s payout machines or anything like that, or have one they want to donate to me for my cause? Or?
Why 30s? Why you first?
I always play pinball. I guess I'm like the Tommy song. Ever since I was a young boy, I always played pinball.
And where, Aaron, did you grow up, a pinball era?
Well, that's what I was getting to. I grew up in Ohio, and when I would go visit my aunt, she'd give me a bunch of dimes and nickels, and I'd go down to the laundry room and play pinball. When I was in high school, I worked for a vending company, which was in the 70s. And so it's all EMs. And then as I was going through college, I was working for them, repairing their digital boards, because at that time, all the EM mechanics had these big, huge Weller 440 soldering guns that they would, you know, weld all the coils back together. And you go do that on a digital board, you get about 3 seconds and the whole digital board shot. So you needed some college geek that could work on digital boards. I've worked on pinballs before, so I liked them. And let's flash ahead, graduate college, go work for Motorola, different companies, blah, blah, blah. Meet my wife, get married. And I'm over at her house one day, and you know, this is really boring. So she goes, let's go up to the attic. I'm like, hey, yeah, let's go up to the attic. She goes, that's not what you think. She goes, when I was a little kid, my uncle, who was a big Slovak guy, worked at a speakeasy as a bouncer. And the story goes, there's two stories. I like this story better than the other story. The first story was he traded him for a washing machine. For my book, that's boring. The one that I got told by her grandmother before she passed away was that he knew the place was going to get raided. They had some sort of signaling device that they knew the cops were coming and stuff like that. So they had a Mills Silent, which was, people know as a castle front slot machine. He took that under one arm. Now remember, this is a big old European Slovak immigrant. He took the Mills rocket, or blue ribbon, underneath the other arm, went trapping out the back door, got down the street, go to a friend's house, and she's had them ever since. And when she was a little kid, she played the 30s machine. That's what she took me up to Ag to play. So I played the 30s pin. I said, this is really cool. You know, I played EMs, I played digitals, you know, I played all the stuff. I even played like Balls of Poppin' and Humpty Dumpty and stuff, and that era doesn't do much for me. And this was really cool. And then I met Dick Bouchot. And Dick was just, if you've ever met Dick Bouchot, you're honored to sit and talk with him. When he gave a speech, he had so much enthusiasm. He could talk for an hour on a laser pointer. and make you want this laser pointer so bad you'd sell your house and rent your wife. He just had an enthusiasm for whatever he talked about. And I talked to Dick and we became friends. And I remember we were at Chicagoland, which is a show that's held in the spring and the fall here in Chicago. Actually, I think it's held next week. And I bought a game, and literally it was firewood. But it was a game. It was a 30s game. It was another 30s game. And I saw him in the parking lot. I go, Dick, tell me about this game. And he goes, oh, my God, that's a Jennings. It's, they made this many of this game, and, oh, you know, Steve Kordak did this, and so-and-so did this, and, oh, you know, that's such a fine when you restore it. It's going to be so great, and, you know. And I go, this is great. My wife goes, it's firewood. You know, you'll never do it. But it's like all the way home, I'm dreaming in the back of my mind, well, gee, if I do this and do stuff like that. And he just got me so excited about 30s machines and collecting the piece of history, because he always said, if you don't start it now and somebody doesn't collect it, keep that history alive and excite other people, it's going to go away. Just like when they tear down the building, people go, oh, I want a skyscraper here. I need a parking lot. I don't need that old piece of crap building. Bulldozers come in and tear it down. 10 years later, somebody goes, you know, if we kept that beautiful theater, our town would have been much better off. And we can't afford to rebuild it now. They'll never come back. And that's the way it is with old games. And we're even getting to the point now where people have lost interest from the early 30s, 35, 37, when they started getting bigger, up until the flipper era. I really don't know anybody who's collecting that era. And it's just going away. And once those machines are gone, they're never coming back. And so I've always been excited about it. And as Walt will attest, I'm so excited that the dogs take their paw and go every time they come by because there's no room in my house. I have pinball machines sitting on the game room floor, in the guest bedroom, all over the place. The 30s room you can no longer get into. All my storage lockers are full. And as a matter of fact, I was moving something the other day. I bought a roller coaster car, and my wife goes, this is what we need. So we're pushing into the building, and I'm moving all these slot machines and stuff out of the way, and she goes, oh, this is interesting. I said, what's that? And she goes, it's a crate. She goes, let's stack it with the other crates that you ship stuff out in. Because if I buy a machine from you, I ship you a crate, and you ship me the machine back in. And so I go to pick it up. And the crate's not empty. And I look at the label. It says, from California. Look at the date. It's a year and a half ago. And I look at the seals, and the seals have never been opened on the crate. Needless to say, I didn't have time. The crate's still sitting at home sealed. Sometime this winter when I'm really bored and down in the dumps, I'm going to go out there with my drill and open it up and see what treasure I got. But I truly wish that all of you get excited about the pinball sport, and that's why you're here. Even if it's just find a new niche, find a Bally, find a Williams, find a Gottlieb, find something that you want to collect, and do the best that you can in collecting it. And that will keep the history alive, inspire other people. Talk to Rob. Come up here and talk about something you like. Any questions before I get out of here?
Do you collect any of the other non-payout games from 30s, like the push-ups and the...
Oh, yeah. I don't do the push-em-ups because I would totally run out of room. I have a friend up in Michigan that has about 60 of them up on the wall. I got one just for an example. But, yeah, I have a, as you probably saw on the first slide, I got ballyhoos and stuff like that. I have over 100 1930s machines, and probably have 200 machines other than that in my collection, so I have 300 machines total. But you got to remember, from 1930 to 1934 was the highest production, and the most companies were in business. Again, we're in the Depression. You're making furniture. You're not selling furniture. Somebody's making pinball machines. They're selling pinball machines and making money. You have a woodworking shop. You can put pins on the table. They may have only produced two machines, but they were a company, and they produced pinball machines. So there was more pinball manufacturers between 1930 and 1934, and more machines made than any time in history. So, anything else?
Yes, real quick. Do you collect trade stimulators from thermals?
Yes.
Okay, do you know anything about Selectum? I got it for like $200 at the Wayne Show.
Sure, after the deal, I'll talk to you on the hall or something like that.
We got to talk about that.
Yeah. Yes, sir. No, I don't sell any of my spare parts. Even my firewood machine I keep. I've sold two pinballs in my life. The first one was just a mistake selling it. The second one was a couple years ago. The guy just made me an offer that I absolutely positively couldn't refuse, and I really didn't want the machine. It was a Grand Lizard. He paid shipping. He paid me like $2,000 for it. He's out in California, and I guess he really loves the machine, so I wish him all the luck. I don't sell them. I actually manufacture some of my own parts because you can't get them. And so I'll take, and I have a machine shop that I go to, and I take the broken or missing part drawing, and I'll sit there and I'll mill my own parts or make whatever I have to make. Even you can't buy the dry cell batteries anymore. And I don't know if anybody knows about electronics, they have big capacitors. And so I'll take those and put labels around them and use a little wall warts to power the machines, but the capacitors will charge up enough energy for the one time the coil has to kick, that it has enough current to make that coil kick. And if you open up the machine, it looks like there's a row of dry cell batteries sitting in there. So if you need something, contact me and we'll see.
So you want it back next year is the question.
Yeah.